So he doesn't raise it to the
No, he's got to come and admit that the conspiracy.
He's got to admit that he's conspired to fix the dog races in order to make that defense, and I...
Well, yeah, but...
All he's got to do is contend that he has been tried for this conspiracy. Yeah, he's already been held in jeopardy for this conspiracy. He can admit whatever he wants, and
he's home free. But you've got a subsequent crime, though, that's been committed, don't you, Frank?
What?
Don't you charge him on that? Even though he may, you've only got one conspiracy, if you have five separate crimes, he's going to be guilty as a
well,
as an accomplice, isn't he?
You're going to have problems with this statute, because any time you have, I mean, right now, so he commits a robbery in Corvallis and a robbery in Salem. Or he holds up two different banks here in Salem. You can indict him and try him on both of them.
Right.
And if he happens to get off on one, I mean, you still got him on the other. But now, so if it's progressed to the point where you can try him on the substance offenses, although you're going to have problems with, you're going to have to fight this statute every time. I mean, the prosecution is. I mean, it's going to be raised every time that this was part of a conspiracy. But anytime you indict a person for a conspiracy, that is not being the actual one who's going out and doing the holding.
If the bank's been robbed, Frank, why would you charge him with conspiracy? If he's involved, if he's been involved in the planning to commit the robbery of the bank and the bank is in fact robbed, wouldn't you charge him with robbery? Wouldn't he be guilty as a party to the crime?
Yeah. Only the big boys that you can't get on it would be on the conspiracy.
As a practical thing, who would charge a guy with all these separate checks? That just doesn't happen. Anyway, does it?
Mm-hmm. Well,
you're doing the substantive offense.
Yeah, but that's my point. We're talking about completed crimes there, and here
yeah.
George is talking about a conspiracy with multiple criminal objectives, not a conspiracy that has resulted in multiple crimes. If
yeah.
you've got multiple crimes,
then
you're
trying the crime.
You're going to be able to charge the man for the substantive offense. All George is saying is that if two guys get together and conspire to rob 10 separate banks, that you can't charge him with a separate conspiracy for each criminal objective, each separate bank. He's not saying, though, that if they do in fact rob 10 separate banks, that this is going to be any defense to it.
Well,
also
you talk about this continuous conspiratorial relationship. And then he goes ahead and says that this provision applies even though it is renewed or the conspiratorial relationship is extended. This still means, at least to me, that once you have a man in organized crime that has been acquitted on a conspiracy charge or has been convicted on a conspiracy charge, he has double jeopardy from then on out.
Frank, it can't work practically because your complaint's going to say that he conspired with A, B, and C to, what was your first one? Fix the dog races.
Okay.
You try him, he's acquitted. Then you come back and you conspire with A, B, and C to go in a numbers racket. Well, your double jeopardy is for the same crime in the same jurisdiction.
Well, but
so
that's what this doesn't. This extends your double jeopardy to
you're saying
that
a lifetime immunity to any hood who gets acquitted of a conspiracy charge as long as he keeps conspiring in the same group.
Yeah, as long as it's part of the same continuous conspiratorial relationship.
Well, if he's going to defend it on that basis, then he's got to admit that his conspiracy...
Well, it's the same. Yeah, but it's the same thing.
No, this wasn't a conspiracy to rob the university branch of the bank. This was a conspiracy to rob 10 banks, and it was never done. Nothing was ever done about it. No? This will be his defense.
Yeah. Now, like, say I shoot my wife. You try me, and I'm acquitted. What's wrong with me going out and saying, "Ha ha ha! I did shoot my wife." You see. There's nothing, I mean, the police and the prosecutor can sit there and look mean daggers at you, but that's all they can do to you,
okay,
you
for
see.
One specific crime, but if he is acquitted on the conspiracy to fix the dog races,
no,
that's the crime
it's
of conspiring to fix the dog races.
Yeah, but if you're
all right,
also
but
on the other stuff.
Well,
sure.
Look at what
look at what Platt says on page 42. A and B agree to rob a bank. In order to accomplish this goal, they steal a car, break into a hardware store, and steal some guns, all for the purpose of robbing a bank. Under this section, they can be convicted only of one conspiracy, not for separate counts, a conspiracy to steal a car, a conspiracy to burglarize, a conspiracy to rob the bank.
Yeah, but he doesn't talk about where they got a number of banks, whether you're talking about just plain organized crime, which your conspiracy involves prostitution, drugs, and everything else.
Well, but your hypothetical is one where he's acquitted of a charge of conspiring to rob a bank, and then he's tried on a charge of conspiring to fix the dog races, and he comes in and says it was all part of one conspiracy. But the fact finder doesn't have to believe that.
In other words,
the government has indicted him on a charge of conspiring to rob a bank. They try him and he's acquitted. Then 3 weeks later, they indict him on conspiring to fix the dog races. And he comes in and says, I want shelter under Section 8. But that doesn't mean that the fact finder has to agree that the scheme to fix the dog races was the same scheme as robbing a bank.
I mean, if it all came out of that same meeting,
well,
then he's going to have to affirmatively show that.
Certainly he is, but there's no harm in doing it. I mean, just
if they believe
his
it to be true.
Here is not a good example because it says A and B agreed to rob a bank. In order to accomplish this, they steal a car, break into a car, store, and steal some guns. Well, any prosecutor is going to charge him with the substantive offenses. You're going to bother with it. But suppose they don't do this, they just agree to do it. Now, is he going to have to prove every one of these things, that they conspired to do all of these things?
See, really, we say the thing back here where we talk about the conspiracy will be the major crime or something. Somewhere we're talking about, like, the highest possible offense. Like, you wouldn't charge... It wouldn't be a conspiracy to solicit for murder. It would be a conspiracy of murder. And this is basically what he's saying here, is that, I mean, by his example, is that the conspiracy is bank robbery. It's not conspiracy of stealing a car, and it's not... that's what his example says. But...
Well, I think that's what he meant to say here in his hypothetical on 42, really. I think he meant that if they agree to steal a car and to steal a gun and then to rob the bank, remembering that we're talking about an inchoate crime here, that the bank robbery hasn't occurred yet, the car hasn't been stolen, and the gun hasn't been stolen, that you can't charge them with conspiracy to do each one of these things. But you're not saying that if they, in fact, go out and steal the car or... steal the gun and then rob the bank, that they haven't committed three separate crimes.
Because what bothers me is, in order to get a conviction under this statute, does the prosecutor have to prove a conspiracy to do each one of these things? And if he fails in the proof of any one, then the man's not guilty.
Each one of what things?
To rob the bank, steal the car, and steal some guns.
No, not if you... let's say, for example, you...
No, the man comes in and says, yes, I sat down here with Joe and agreed with him that we would go rob a bank. But I didn't agree to rob a hardware store or steal some guns. I didn't have anything to do with it. Well, he'd be not guilty. Yeah, because it's one continuous offense.
Well, I think you're right there. If he's charged with conspiracy, say, to commit robbery, and he's acquitted on that, then you can't charge him then with conspiracy to steal the car in order to commit the bank robbery. Yeah,
but it seems to me like this is a thing that could, I'm not saying it will, but it could very well tie the prosecutor's hands and make the prosecution very difficult on some of these.
It would seem to me that this statute, I mean, having this in makes no more sense than having a statute that would say, if a person commits, say, three bank robberies, he can only be tried for one. or if he writes 10 checks, he can only be tried for one. I mean, like, it's just going to complicate the thing to no end.
You're overlooking the difference between a conspiracy and a substantive crime. If you write 10 checks,
you've got to keep in mind. Yeah,
if you write 10 checks, you've committed 10 crimes. But what this is saying is that if you conspire to write 10 checks, you've committed one conspiracy, not 10 conspiracies, and so you can't convict him of 10 counts of conspiracy.
But what does the prosecutor allege in this respect?
He alleges that Frank Knight and Jim Burns conspired, and the object of the conspiracy was to write 10 bad checks, period.
Now, can I do that, or do you have to allege that they conspired to cash a check, et cetera, et cetera?
No.
You can allege it simply that they conspired
so long as
to... Well, this was my question on
The alleged object of the conspiracy is conduct which, in and of itself, constitutes...
Well, this was part of my reason for asking you, how do you allege a conspiracy? Do you conspire to... can you allege simply that they conspired to rob a bank? Or do you have to allege that they conspired to rob the Corvallis branch of the First National Bank, you see?
No, I think... the easiest way to answer this is I'll get a hold of some typical indictments. Sid Lezak real easy and just send them to you, but the charging language of your conspiracy indictment is relatively simple. It may be, some of them may be lengthy indictments in some of these housing and mail fraud schemes, but essentially the language is pretty simple, and the reason they're lengthy is because traditionally they have alleged a lot of separate overt acts. This is a tactical reason for doing that. It impresses the jury, and you don't have to prove all the overt acts as long as you prove one of them. But basically, they allege the object of the conspiracy is to rob a bank.
Okay. Now, the broader the conspiracy is, the more protection a person has. Now, I can see and understand and accept that if our conspiracy here is simply to go out and write 10 checks or just pass checks over the weekend or whatever it is, this is one conspiracy. But suppose our conspiracy is much, much broader. It comes as setting up a criminal syndicate to operate throughout the whole state, so that rather than us just meeting here for 30 minutes and planning everything, we meet here for several days, setting up a whole great organization. But it's all one conspiracy right there. I mean, it's going to involve prostitution, drugs, numbers, a few homicides. We got to bump off some guy up in Portland that's not going to let us move in there, but it's all one conspiracy. But it involves multiple crimes, and so therefore, once you're tried on one of the crimes, it's the outgrowth of that conspiracy. You're home free.
But
you got double jeopardy there.
That assumes you got an indictment. Let's say that reads that A and B conspired and agreed, and the object and purpose of the conspiracy was to take over Vice in Portland, Oregon. Well, that, in the first place, you wouldn't have good indictments. You'd have to be more specific than that. You'd have to allege that the object and purpose of the conspiracy was the commission of one or more specific substantive crimes, like, say, writing 10 bad checks. Number two was to set up bawdy houses, and number three is set up bootleg liquor joints, and number four is fix dog races and so on, whatever.
Yeah, but you're trying to, you're setting those up in counts, which of course you couldn't do.
Well,
because it's one conspiracy. You see, it's only one crime. It's not two or three different crimes. It's only one crime. So you might pick what you thought was the best one, I mean, that you had the best proof on the setting up of the body houses or something, and go on that one. But you'd have to keep in mind that once you've tried it, you're through.
Well, why would you, if you've got proof of a conspiracy and it was all planned and agreed upon at the same time by the same people, why would you be any better off to charge him with conspiring to set up the body houses as conspiring to do one of the other acts?
It's just one conspiracy.
Well, because
you may not be able to prove all of it. He may be able to get one of the co-conspirators to testify as to we conspired to do so and so and so and so. But he can't get anyone to testify to the other part of it. Now, what would bother me is that if he's got to allege, as I assume he would have to, the continuous conspiratorial relationship, and he fails to prove some part of this, then is the whole thing out? Does he have to say that everybody sat around this group and we agreed to do these five or six different things? And maybe he can't get anyone to testify. Well, no, I agreed to rob a bank and I agreed to do this, but I didn't agree to kill the guard.
This is what it's about, though. No. This thing is centered to protect a person from being, if he really agreed only once, this is to protect him from being punished for having agreed to multiple objectives because he's only agreed once. This is all it's about, isn't it?
So,
well, that's why
conspiracy
as a crime is the agreement, and we're going to punish him for the agreement. I don't think it has anything to do with these other things. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm not.
Well,
and I'm in favor of limiting it. The crime is a little bit too.
Well, what I was wondering is this subject of multiple crimes and multiple charges and so on is one that's not just limited to conspiracy.
Yeah.
That if it's something you considered in the way of a double jeopardy statute or something relative to the charging and sentencing on multiple crimes
we
generally.
I don't think we've got to that section yet.
That's what I'm saying. This is no different than saying, I mean, if you go down and rob a string of banks, you've only committed one crime.
No, Ferdy's right, though. So you've agreed once. You've conspired once commit 1 or 10 crimes, but the crime is the agreement.
But if you then go ahead and commit the ten crimes, then you've committed ten crimes.
Well, that's a different story.
That's a different can of worms.
Just sitting down and talking is it, I can't see any particular benefit to this statute, except as it may relate to multiple crimes, multiple charges, and multiple sentences. As would apply to any crime.
I think your or continuous conspiratorial relationships is the troublesome language.
Yeah.
Would it do to take that out?
Prosecution for each meeting of the conspirators, I assume.
I feel stupid about it because I don't know enough about it. I've got the strong feeling that there's a bunch of federal cases that this is the way it's written here.
It's not going to do anything to the guy who actually is the fall guy that goes out and commits the crimes. I mean, it's not going to do anything to protect him. It's going to be the protector under double jeopardy for the king man.
You going to break it?
Why don't we take a short break?
Okay.
Get together with him on it.
Where are we now then if we're moving? Section 9?
Well, we have to wait. Dave, while you and I we were talking about the idea of possibly passing along Section 8 to the full commission with the notion that Frank and Professor Platt get together themselves and hopefully work out some wording that will be satisfactory to each one. I wonder if we can't, with the understanding, send it along with that understanding, that we then move to Section 9. Would anybody object if we did that? Okay. Then that brings us to Section 9. Speaking of Section 8, This is the one dealing with now this is the one. This is the one dealing with joinder, severance, and venue. And, this is the one which I had some objection to, and that's why that correspondence was had with Sid Lezak, because I felt that would be of some help. What are your thoughts on Section 9?
I don't know, this is probably extraneous, but what if there is a conspiracy going on by telephone and there people are maybe even out of state? How does the state handle that?
Well, gee, I don't know.
Pardon?
You mean if you phoned across the river to Vancouver and said, let's get together and rob the metropolitan branch of the U.S. National Bank. I think they could prosecute you and the guy across the river. I wouldn't see any problem there. Of course, any time you get across state lines and use the phone and that sort of thing, why, you may have some federal jurisdiction involved, but it wouldn't negate state involvement if the object of the conspiracy were a state crime.
Well, part of this necessity for Section 9 comes out of Section 8, doesn't it?
Oh, I don't
because,
really think so.
To try to make it all one conspiracy.
See, this would work a rather profound change in Oregon law, because presently, even in a conspiracy case, an Oregon defendant has a right to a separate trial. This would say that you can try them jointly unless the court orders a severance, and so on. And it also has, in 1 sub B, it says that you can try separate conspiracies together so long as they separate conspiracies constitute different aspects of a scheme of organized criminal conduct. And that would be quite a change. That would be new in the United States, I think.
Well, but as
maximum guilt by association possible, wouldn't it?
Well, but as a practical matter, that the state is going to have to request severance whenever they have a confession from one of the defendants, because he's going to have to be tried separately. Now, as far as the statements made, you know, during the course of the conspiracy, this type of thing, those that the state can prove, of course, that would be admissible even, would be admissible anyway. But where, if you've got a confession from one of the defendants, he is certainly going to have to be tried separately, because the Supreme Court has now said that you can't instruct a jury to disregard something or apply it only to one and trust them to do it.
Well, assume that there is no confession, and then that you've got 10 dirty birds and one guy that perhaps there isn't as much against, and you join them all. He's going to go down the drain, as the judge said.
But Frank, I'm not sure that rule applies to trials in which they're all joined.
Sure it does. You're going to have separate trials for the joint defendants. I mean, if you've got a confession.
You mean under the Bruton cases and that line of cases?
Yeah, that you can't admit, like, if Dave and I are being tried for burglary and I've confessed. Yeah. Well, certainly if Dave were tried separately, my confession after, you know, I was in custody, wouldn't be admissible in Dave's trial. So now, you, even though we were indicted together, you know, acting together pursuant to common intent, he's going to have a separate trial because I have confessed, because the jury would hear my confession, and that they cannot do. Even though the jury court is going to instruct that they're to use my confession only as against me.
Well, I guess I haven't read those cases carefully. If that's what those cases say, then it seems to me we ought to send this section back to George and tell him to rework it, because I hesitate to express myself, but I don't think that's what those cases say, but I haven't really read them that carefully.
Well, I had four defendants, you know, all involved in the same burglary. They all confessed, identical confessions.
Figures.
Form.
Mimeograph confession prepared for them.
Not quite. And basically they just admitted being at a party and having a few beers and deciding they'd go out and get some more beers, basically what their confession was. And a couple of them were inside and a couple of them weren't. And we had to try them all separately because of the Bruton case, because... Well. I tried to get the defense counsel...
Yeah, but you couldn't have tried them jointly in any event under present Oregon practice if they'd have requested a separate trial. My understanding, and I could be mistaken, is that my understanding is that Bruton doctrine would not be applicable in a conspiracy-type trial where all defendants are present and being proceeded against. I could be mistaken on that, though.
Well, of course, not. Like, say if it's any statements made in the course of the conspiracy, whether you call it a conspiracy or whether being tried for conspiracy or not, are admissible.
Bruton doesn't affect that.
No, Bruton doesn't affect that at all. But it's only when they've been arrested and so the conspiracy has come to a close and they are in custody, that one person's statements can only be used against him and not his co-conspirators, that you got to have separate trials.
I don't see what violence section 9 would do to that, Frank. You've got your severance provisions under 2. The court shall order a severance as to any defendant whose sole request, if it deems it necessary or appropriate to the fair determination of his guilt or innocence, and shall take any other proper measures to protect the fairness of the trial.
Is it my understanding that presently it's not discretionary, it's a matter of right for a separate trial?
In Oregon, you have as a separate trial as a matter of right.
It's 136.060.
We're now making it discretionary with the court.
This would be the equivalent of the federal rule now as to severance, joinder or severance in conspiracy cases.
And that works so well.
There are all kinds of problems with multiple defendants in one trial, sure.
Well, yeah, there's no question it's a problem. We also have a problem in this thing about sub B of in effect trying two separate conspiracies together, so long as you got a contention or that they constitute different aspects of a scheme of organized criminal conduct.
Well, of course, that was the language, I think, that Sid Lezak's Jack Collins objected to. Says, however, the draft would permit joinder for trial of different conspiracies representing, quote, different aspects of a scheme of organized criminal conduct and having totally different parties. I object, says, should such a situation arise, all parties should either be joined in a single conspiracy or separate conspiracies should be charged, or the various defendants should be charged with particular substantive crimes.
See, this is the part that goes back to George's theory that it's all one conspiracy, you see. You don't have multiple conspiracies. It's just one conspiracy. So whether I took part in the first of the conspiracy or whether I took part in the latter part of the conspiracy, our conspiracy, you see, is to saturate Oregon with organized crime, and so it's just one conspiracy. It doesn't involve several of them.
This also presents a good question as to how and who makes the determination of whether or not the conspiracies are so related as to constitute different aspects of a single scheme of organized criminal conduct. Would that be made by the judge or by a jury? And you've got some real problems there, too. Do you do it ahead of time? I suppose maybe you do. I don't know.
Well, I would think so.
Do you have to make a showing? Have to make a showing.
Determination by the court.
But then, by the same token, on the venue question, if it's a very large conspiracy, you're going to have a venue question, because I can be tried. If we agree here, I could be tried in Marion County, and or anywhere where an overt act occurred by either by myself or a person with whom I conspired. But when it gets beyond in a real,
of course, if you don't have overt acts in your definition of conspiracy, how do you determine venue?
You know, there's also I would assume for the trial judges particularly an extremely difficult question presented by this, the statement, the admissibility against him of the acts or declaration of another shall not be enlarged. I don't know what that means.
I don't either.
But I assume that if you've got a conspiracy of this group, that some part of them go out and get it, inspire them to do something else. I mean, this joint type thing that's mentioned in 7 and this, that the acts of your declarations of one are going to have to be limited to
the members of that conspiracy.
To the members of that group, and how you'd weed this out in a...
Well, in other words, you'd have a damage admission by a member of conspiracy B, and all the members of conspiracy A would be hollering their heads off, because how's the jury going to remember not to apply that to them?
Mm-hmm.
Which,
yeah,
is, of course, is a standard objection in any conspiracy.
Yep.
Trial. Yep. Well, so I'm not really so sure we ought to get into Section 9 at this point. Maybe he justifies it because he says that procedure is so interrelated that it goes along with the substantive definition of conspiracy, but maybe it'd be better to put this over till we get into the procedural part.
Well, I think we could do that easily enough. I think that if we took what he has suggested up to Section 9 and it were enacted into law, and we didn't make any changes in our procedural law, I don't think you'd have any particular difficulty in applying our current procedural statutes to it. I think all he was trying to do was to spell it out with respect to conspiracy.
So that when we were thinking about conspiracy and had it all fresh in our mind, we could decide the whole thing rather than looking back.
Of course, I hate to chop his work up with in his absence. That's a darn thing about it.
Well, of course, we could do this. Of course, you can do anything you want. We'll come back down to it. I mean, you could strike it, or you could send it on with a do not pass recommendation. You know, if you want to do that, advise the commission that the subcommittee recommends against the adoption of Section 9, if that's the way you feel. And then at that time, hopefully, George would be available to stand up for the section if he feels that he wants to.
Why don't we move to send it along with a recommendation either that we don't approve the substance of it, or alternately that we recommend that it be taken out of this chapter and put back in the procedure, and then have the commission decide it when George is present. Is that agreeable to everybody?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good solution.
Marvelous how you solve these problems by bypassing.
Yeah.
Okay, Don, we're at number 10.
Downing Street. Well, this is just your renunciation defense. Again, only this applies to conspiracy. Affirmative defense again. Burden on the defendant.
Same as solicitation, isn't it, Don?
Yeah.
It's the same language as it is on the other part.
Well, pretty much.
Pretty,
he's got a little different language in here. He has thwarted the success of the conspiracy, you see. And also language that renunciation by one conspirator does not affect the liability of another who does not join the renunciation, which is really kind of stating the obvious, I suppose. It's probably a good idea to spell it out.
Yeah. Any objection to Section 10? If not, why don't we move to Section 11?
Now, Section 11 really is procedure again, I suppose.
Could I just make one quick comment? Does he have to thwart the success by renouncing?
Well, I think he'd have to. he'd have to show that he actually did thwart the success. Not that he wanted to, but he actually did renunciate voluntarily, and that this caused the conspiracy to go down the drain, in other words.
In other words, he's got to run into the police station.
Well, success of the conspiracy. He's got to intend to do it and do it.
Well,
if
look what he says here,
isn't it?
Page 53. Renunciation must take place before the performance of any of the criminal conduct contemplated by the conspiracy. Renunciation after that point may relieve the defendant's liability for future substantive offenses, but will not relieve his liability for the conspiracy charge.
We could do dirty things with that. I could talk you guys all into doing something, then I could run over and report to the police. You'd all be guilty, and I'd be innocent.
Then we'd claim entrapment.
Yeah, but I'm just a plain old guy,
Can't think terribly.
Sir, think encouragement.
Huh?
Encouragement.
Well,
just to add another. That was kind of ridiculous, maybe, but it's all part of the same thing. If the conspiracy is one continuing conspiracy, and I have renunciated, under this, his talking here, I'm not relieved of that which has gone on so far. That is, the first two banks, but the other six banks that we talked about and planned on, I won't be responsible for. So what does that do? If it's just one conspiracy, I'm only half guilty then, or a third guilty if it's two out of six. I don't know. I just don't like that Section 8 or Section 9.
What about Section 11, Frank? Duration.
This is strictly the application of the statute of limitations.
Now, statute of limitations, generally, the commission has adopted the policy that we will deal with that in procedure.
This is the cutoff time in Section 11.
Well, what do you think, Don?
Got to start it sometime, and looks to me like they're reasonable points of determining a statute.
Yeah, well, what it means is we want to make sure that every sentence for conspiracy sentences him to custody for a longer period of time than the statute of limitations, so when he comes back out and starts doing the same thing again, he can be charged with a new conspiracy. Otherwise, if you don't have him in there, you don't get that conspiracy terminated, you see.
You're evil.
You see, he goes right back and starts doing it again, and he's home free because his conspiracy hasn't terminated.
Of our code, I hate to see us get so fragmented and chop it up and have some procedure someplace and some other places.
I think that's right.
I suppose, and I imagine a law professor would make a good argument that statute of limitations really is substantive law and not procedural. Just for organization of the code, If we're going to put some of this in procedure, I'd like to see us recommend that it all go in procedure.
It might ultimately go into a procedure section, Don, but aren't we dealing kind of like this, that when we come to statute limitations in procedure, what we think of more is it's statute limitations for misdemeanors 2 years and for a felony is 3 years. And that there are special problems with conspiracy that in determining when the statute of limitations applies. So, I mean, this the statute of limitation on conspiracy probably would go into the procedural section, maybe right with statute of limitations, but there are some special problems with.
Well, yeah, there's special problems, and that's the whole reason I think he has a Section 11 is so that when you look at our statute of limitations section, you'll know how you to apply that to a conspiracy situation.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it's not an overwhelming problem.
Well, does anybody have any specific objections to the wording of it, apart from the question of whether we want it here or in the procedure section?
Points out this is exactly model penal code language, section 5.03 sub 7, and it's close to, California has a similar provision, but Michigan, Illinois, and New York have not made any provision for abandonment as it affects the running of the statute of limitations for the crime of conspiracy.
We don't have any present law which deals with this, as I understand it, do we?
No. Uh-uh.
How's it covered then?
Well, there aren't any cases on it. I suppose it's
never come up, apparently.
It hadn't come up in an appellate case that I'm aware of. But I think
well, there have just been so few.
Well, I think we've got some cases on the termination of it, but not with respect to the statute of limitations.
Yeah, we've got the cases that say the point at which you can no longer use statements against the rest of them and so on. But that's just generally what the rule is.
Yes.
Once it's terminated, whatever that point may be, then admissions are not binding on the others for statements. Well, what is your pleasure? Section 11.
That's all right.
Why don't we pass it along to the commission raise before the commission the question of whether they want it here or in the procedural section and let the commission decide.
That's a good idea.
How long do you want to run, Don?
Well, we're almost through.
only one more section, do we?
Yeah, if we can just hang in there.
12, 13, 14.
So,
well, why don't we see how far we get with section 12?
Okay. Right, section 12, except as provided in subsection 2 of this section, is immaterial to the liability of a person who solicits or conspires with another to commit a crime that A, he or the person whom he solicits or with whom he conspires does not occupy a particular position or have a particular characteristic which is an element of such crime, if he believes that one of them does, or B, the person whom he solicits or with whom he conspires is irresponsible or has immunity to prosecution or conviction for the commission of the crime, or in the case of conspiracy has feigned the agreement, or C, the person with whom he conspires has not been prosecuted for or convicted of the conspiracy or a crime based upon the conduct in question or has previously been acquitted.
Is this statutorily encouraging entrapment? The pretending of the agreement or the immunity of prosecution?
No.
Well, I don't think.
Because not under the definition of entrapment, if not like Don's idea here, if he comes in and puts it in our minds to do it and we're otherwise innocent, law-abiding citizens, then we'd be entrapped. But if he comes to our meeting and we plan something, say, how's that sound to you, Don? And he says, okay, I guess, you know. All right, I'll go along with it. And then goes down and tells, well, that's not entrapment.
How about the informer that may be sitting in for the police on a conspiracy and he feigns agreement?
I'm sure that's what it's there for.
You almost have to have it.
Yeah.
All right.
Don, I don't understand why this says except as provided in subsection 2 of this section. Now, where's subsection 2?
Yeah, that's what I was looking for and didn't see it. But
see, that's a good question, Judge.
There you go, reading them again.
The ones that I didn't want you to see.
It's right there, isn't it? It's on page 63, it says subsection 2 establishes the policy that the victim of a crime, although it dissipated and so on.
Well, let's see where he took this from, and I can tell you.
Well, this other blue sheet is section 2. Only we got one of them typed up in white and one of them in, is that blue or green?
No, that's the text of
that's model penal code, and of course he draws his section here is taken from
the
model
penal code.
But look over here on page 64.
Yeah.
You see that's 1 and 2. Right there.
Well, yeah, but that's model penal code. See?
Yeah, but that's where he gets his section 12 is.
That's what I mean. What should have been subsection 2 in there is subsection 2 of.
I think Frank is right. I think that we've got an extra green sheet in the center. It shouldn't be there. It should be a white sheet.
Yeah, subsection I think that probably when they typed this up, they got the.
I've got page 61. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we've got. That's.
Yeah, for the reason it's to work.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, subsection 2, a victim of crime.
Subsection 2 is not too illogical. Apparently it says that you cannot be convicted of conspiring to commit an act if the act isn't a crime, which seems kind of reasonable.
Well, there's a whole bunch of law on the subject, too. The gal who willingly lets herself be statutorily raped or something isn't guilty of statutory rape. This is quite complex.
Yeah, what this is intended to do is to tie it in with their section on accomplices under their section 206. And under 206.5, a person who is legally incapable of committing a particular offense himself may be guilty thereof if it is committed by the conduct of another person for which he is legally accountable, unless such liability is inconsistent with the purpose of the provision establishing his incapacity. Now that, although he has participated in its completion, who cannot be held for the substantive crime, because, say, the crime is defined in such a way that the victim is excluded as a type, as a class of persons who would be guilty, cannot be held for soliciting the crime or conspiring to commit the crime. Example would be crimes for which the consenting behavior of more than one person is inevitably incident, such as statutory rape, abortion, bribery, or unlawful sale.
In other words, the bribee cannot be guilty of conspiring to commit bribery. That's what the rapee in statutory rape can't be guilty of conspiring to commit statutory rape. Isn't that what it says?
Yeah, and there's a whole bunch of law to that effect. Historically,
which kind of makes sense.
Well, then why is it a defense to a charge of solicitation or conspiracy to commit a crime, that if the criminal object were achieved, the actor would not be guilty? So it wouldn't be solicitation if, say, I went to an underage girl, said, "Why don't you have sexual intercourse with Dave?"
It's if the girl said to the boy, "Why don't you have intercourse with me?" Now she can't be guilty of statutory rape, and now she can't be guilty of soliciting statutory rape either. That's what the thing is getting at, because she can't be guilty of statutory rape.
I see. The actor is the, it's a
what
defense. Okay. This, the actor, I was thinking of somebody else as being the actor rather than the defendant.
Solicitor.
We have a similar section in our draft on parties to crime, where we're dealing with accomplices to completed criminal acts. So this would not be inconsistent with that. And 206.6. Yeah, now 206.6. A, under the Model Penal Code, it's a person cannot be an accomplice in an offense committed by another person if he's a victim of that offense. There again, your abortion type situation.
How about prostitution?
Of course, the Oregon cases on that.
How about prostitution?
The male is the victim of the crime of prostitution.
I think
he wouldn't be a victim, but I think he would. His conduct would be necessarily incidental to the commission of the offense. I think, you know, it would take two to commit the crime. He wouldn't be considered a victim, but he'd be considered as necessarily incidental to the commission of the crime, and that's why they have a section that says the offense is so defined that his conduct is inevitably incidental to its commission. So you'd have to have, you wouldn't call him really a victim, but you couldn't have prostitution without without the
man. Well, under some of those, he can be the accomplice for the purpose of the accomplice rule, where you have to have corroboration.
In a prostitution case? I don't think...
I seem to recall some cases... seems to me there's a breaking point in the age factor there, Gordon, on that, as to where... Take where it's a young victim, say a rape or sodomy or a contributing case. It seems to me there's a breaking point on the age factor there as to whether they'd be accomplices or not. With respect to the accomplice rule.
Well, maybe, I don't know about that.
I've got all these cases researched for my other draft on parties, so the Oregon cases, I can get those if you want to check them.
Basically, this section 2 represents pretty much current law all around. That's quite a generalized statement. There are a lot of cases, federal and otherwise.
Yeah, there are a number of Oregon cases on the question of when you're an accomplice for the purposes of the accomplice testimony rule. For example, a prostitutrix in a statutory rape is not an accomplice, or in a fornication, there's an old Oregon case on fornication that says this. And there's a very recent case out of Multnomah County, the abortion case, said that the woman was not an accomplice. That case. I can't remember the name of it, but it's in the advance sheets. It's a Banshee case.
Oh,
sorry, I've got to go there.
Any objection to section 12?
Kind of a little bit. Do we want to adopt something that refers to sections of the Model Penal Code?
That's a drafting matter.
Well, an accomplice under section, then we'd have to refer to our article on accomplices, our parties to crime.
Okay.
Well, no objection to pass section 12. I really have doubt we can get through 13 and 14 yet tonight. Particularly looking at multiple convictions, grading of criminal attempts. From what was said earlier, it just seems to me we're going to—it's going to take longer than we've got available.
My mind has ceased to function.
Yeah, I think everybody's tired anyway.
I've got to be back.
I've got some time problems.
Okay.
What about our next meeting?
Well, it would be set for the third Friday in August.
9:30 a.m., huh?
Well, no, it'd be set for an afternoon meeting. 1:30 again.
No, I mean tomorrow morning. Oh, that's right.
Oh, in the morning, it's 9:30.
Is it 9 or 9:30?
9:30.